Hi, welcome to SaaS Radio Hour. I'm here with Austin again this week to talk about what's new in SaaS. There's been a, three-week gap since we last came on here and chatted about SaaS news. And part of it's been a quiet time, and part of it, there's been quite a few different things that have happened, some of which sort of came together, where there's a few stories together about e-commerce and social stuff. There's a few stories together about trends in the podcast market. And so we thought there'd be some interesting stuff to chat about today. So, hey, Austin, how's it going?
Hey, Matt. Good. How are you doing?
Doing pretty good. Have you seen all the new reviews of Apple's silicon-powered Macs?
Yeah, it is pretty mind-blowing. People are going nuts over it. Like it seems like potentially maybe the MacBook Air, the $999 MacBook Air, is like more powerful than my MacBook Pro. Is that actually right?
Yeah, that looks like what people are saying, which is crazy. Like, there was this one video of, what was it? They downloaded Xcode and extracted the zip file. And it took like 3 minutes on a MacBook Pro, like the top model with an i9 CPU. And it was like, I don't know, 45 seconds on the Apple Silicon. Just absolutely crazy.
Yeah. That's pretty mind blowing, and it's interesting. Yeah, I mean, it's huge leverage for them. And I feel like, I don't know, I would, for them to move off of Intel after all these years, like, very unclear what that. I mean, if you think about some of their other, like, moving off of Google Maps to Apple Maps, which we talked about, I think, in the last episode. Yeah, but it seems like this was a situation where, which makes sense. I mean, they've always been a hardware company, and but it's pretty impressive.
It's funny. I feel like, to a large degree, I pick Apple products partly because of the hardware design and stuff, but mostly for their OS, for their software. But then at the very same time, I would say that Apple's not, I guess, known as much for their software quality as they are for their hardware quality. So shipping something like iCloud or Google or Apple Maps, that were not that great out the gate, seems to be a common trend for Apple. Whereas with hardware, it's more like they make these bets when they really feel confident they've got something interesting. So, yeah, it's a big change to the old Wintel duopoly, where Windows and Intel for years were the backbone of personal computing, and then Apple jumped in by switching to Intel processors, and now Apple's like, goodbye, let's do our own thing. So it'll be interesting to see how it all shakes out in the whole PC industry over the next few years.
Yeah. I mean, it's very clear that they're trying to own more of the supply chain, and like have less kind of risk with whatever sort of global politics and things like that might play out. So yeah, it's interesting.
Absolutely. Which, speaking of the Wintel duopoly, Microsoft was in the news. I believe this was the thing from 2 weeks ago, where Microsoft announced they're adding new features to Excel. So Excel has, of course, their standard hundreds of functions and all the standard tools that you would think of as the core part of Excel. And last year, they'd started adding some extra data types to Excel, which are essentially treated like a mini database, where say you could define a city, right? And it would know that the city is supposed to have a state and a country attached to it as well. And in July this year, Microsoft added what they're calling linked data types, with over 100 different data types, including food, exercise, location, movies, animal breeds, and more. And these are tied into Wolfram Alpha, to let you say, find the calories in an apple. So you would say, write the word apple in an Excel spreadsheet, and then you would give it the food data type. And then you could then say, use a function to find how many calories that apple has. And it can even automatically recognize data types, which I think is interesting from a perspective of Excel being, I guess, one of the original Microsoft desktop software. One of the first pieces of software on a desktop computer most of us would have used. And it's moved to the cloud. There's a web app version of Excel. But then at the very same time, Microsoft has moved towards making Excel web integrated and bringing sort of web features into Excel. And so you've got this desktop software that's, you can run it locally, right? But it, to a big degree, is increasingly both SaaS from a subscription perspective, but then also from being powered by cloud tools. And the thing now, they're letting you now connect to your Power BI databases, so databases in Microsoft's cloud, and use those to add new data types from your own data. So you can make a customer data type that includes all the details that are important for your team in Power BI, and then pull that into Excel, and now Excel knows, okay, here's this linked data. And as Excel's head of product said, data types adds a third dimension to what you can build with Excel. Any single cell can now contain a rich set of structured data, which is an interesting direction, I think, to take the traditional flat spreadsheet.
Yeah, I'm just trying to understand that last bit, like the amount of data that can be contained within a cell. It's really fascinating. I saw Al Chen here and just tapped to invite you, Al, up to speak, because I know that you would have some pretty interesting thoughts on this. And yeah, I think that it's, I guess one question that I have for you, Matt, is like, how is it, this feels like a massive update. Like as someone who's never been like a massive power user of Excel, I feel like it doesn't actually change all that much besides like full version releases. And this feels some pretty big changes. Is that right?
Yeah, it feels like one of those kind of big changes that if it were a normal software release, they would have saved it for a major release. Because it's the kind of thing that would likely get businesses to want to upgrade Excel. Now with subscriptions, you can just strip these features out, and it's something that was released midstream, not exactly in a major feature version, but adds quite a bit of new functionality. And to your question about how much data it can contain, I guess think of it sort of like one cell can be a reference to a database field, right? And then you can reference any other data that was in that database record just from that one cell. So I actually do not know the syntax without looking it up right now, but imagine you had a field that said apple, and you could essentially type equals apple dot calories, and now Excel knows it can pull in that subfield from apple, right, because it's using this web link data. And so you could then build these detailed comically, though, it'd almost not be, for calculations as much as it would be for managing data, for managing CRMs and sales data and customer stuff inside Excel, or at least that's what I think it seems like the main use case would end up being. Al, what's your thoughts on this?
Hey guys, what's up? Can you hear me?
Hey, yeah, how's it going?
Yeah, I heard about this feature. I saw previews of it from various people in the Excel community, and I don't think it's like that big of a, like, in terms of like an Excel feature. I don't think it's that big in terms of like expanding what Excel can do, but I do think it expands the audience of who can use Excel. And the reason I say that is because, so like all this data is stored in Power BI, right? And Power BI is basically allows you to store like many more rows of data than a traditional Excel file, which is, like 1.5 million rows per worksheet or whatever. So in the old days, which is still the way most businesses operate now, like you would probably get a download of your database and you would open it in a CSV file and you save it into an Excel file, and it's super slow and cumbersome to use. But the nice thing is that your customers table, your sales table, the orders tables, they're all in the same spreadsheet. And people would just live with that. And like whenever I need to update my sales table, I just pull down the database again and get my database engineer to give me the file. And then I can have the most quote unquote updated data in my file. So I think with this new updated data type, it's like, I don't need to rely on like a database engineer or someone to like, run a query for me on our database. Like some person on my team is managing all this in Power BI. And then they've set up like, these data types for me to use in my Excel files as a salesperson. I can just like quickly do pivot tables and get the data I need from Power BI into my Excel file. And I don't have to do a bunch of joins with like my sales table, with my orders table with my customers table. So it ends up being like easier to use for like non-technical people. Whereas before, like you needed to have like a, you know, sales operations analyst to do all that kind of pivoting and filtering and sorting for you. So I think it just kind of expands the audience that that's kind of like the end of my statement.
Okay. Yeah. I was just going to ask, do you think that it's like kind of a response to Airtable and some of these other products that have like made more kind of consumer friendly ways to use all these different like kind of database features?
I think so in terms of the UI, but like the actual back end, I don't think is a response to it because Power BI is meant to hold or store like millions of rows of data from what I understand. And things like Airtable and other kind of like no code spreadsheet kind of tools, like they're not meant to hold that many records of data. So mm-hmm. I think Excel is just kind of like playing to their advantage of like, we know that the Power BI, the way our data store is structured, like allows for bigger stores of data that you might put in a database perhaps. And the UI though is like definitely more user-friendly and probably is kind of a response to all these no code spreadsheet tools like Airtable that make it easier to pull in other aspects of your data that doesn't require you to do a bunch of VLOOKUPs basically a bunch of VLOOKUPs to unite your different tables and data together. So, yeah, I think yes and no is basically my short answer.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating. Thank you so much for sharing that. It feels to me like then the big advantage is you end up with individual users have the most up-to-date data because maybe a non-database user historically would have needed to wait for a data team to export the data for them, or worst, just export a CSV file that they're then running with static data. And here you're running with live data from the cloud where you can access much more in one place at one time than you could locally. And so it's almost like giving internal teams the advantage of SaaS, right? Well, by being able to store large amounts of data in the cloud and then be able to access it inside Excel in an interface that pretty much everyone knows how to use.
Yeah, that's my guess, but you know, we'll see. I think it also depends on people having a lot of their, you know, core business operations stored in Excel. And just remember, like, this is like, usually when Microsoft releases these new features, they're only meant for certain people certain companies that have, you know, a premium or professional subscription to Office 365. So a small proportion of people actually will get access to this feature initially. And those are the people that are probably already using a bunch of Microsoft products, including like Azure and a bunch of other stuff. So it's people who are already actively using it. The long tail who are, I think, the real audience, like they're probably still using Excel 2003 or 2007. And, you know, it's like the license has to be renewed, but they kind of keep, like, you know, they don't renew the license whenever they open up the application. And they just literally use Excel to like have a list of data. That's the audience I think a lot of these kind of no-code applications are trying to reach out to. But I think when people see these new features being released from Microsoft, they think like, oh, it's going to change everything. But in reality, it rolls out very slowly to the entire like Microsoft customer base. So that's one thing I keep in mind.
Sounds like a very standard Microsoft strategy, both from a rollout perspective and from a, listening to their largest customers. Odds are there's some major enterprise clients that will find this feature most interesting. Though they're bundling this with Wolfram Alpha as well. So that seems like a way to start getting normal users, especially students, to start using this feature. And then, you know, you can work your way into the business from that perspective as well. Very interesting. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts, Al.
No problem.
Moving on. Next thing that I'd come to that we'd noticed this past few weeks is that Hey, the new email app from Basecamp, they are now rolling out beta invites to Hey for Work, which Hey is basically been the way Basecamp has rethought how email should work. They've split your inbox into three sections if you haven't used it before. You've got your inbox with, or your M box with the M,
with everything in one place. You've got your feed with newsletters split out, and then you've got a paper trail, which is where you're supposed to file receipts and subscription notifications and basically archival emails that you don't really need to look at, but they're important to keep around. Now Basecamp's made this for work, so you can bring your own domain name and create a company Hey account for $12 per user per month, which is, from a pricing perspective, interesting because that's double the price of the base Google Workspace or G Suite plan, and the same price or nearly the same price as Microsoft 365 Business Standard, both of which are giving you email and an entire suite of Office tools. So Hey is making the bet here that entire companies will be willing to pay more for a better email experience inside their company. And the big thing they're claiming to add here is that you can organize emails into collections, which are more or less a folder, but as a thread organized by date, shows attachments and comments inside threads, and you can comment on emails with colleagues instead of CCing an email or CCing someone into an email thread. You can just share that thread with them. So it's like it's got a few of Hey's standard features, and it's got a few features from tools like Front to sort of try to make email collaborative. Which, Austin, do you think that's the kind of thing people want, or do you think people would prefer just to stick with standard email in their business workflows?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really curious. So I started using Hey right away, and then it hasn't stuck for me. I still open it and use it a little bit, but it has not yet become like my kind of core email. I know it's popular because I see people signing up on Capiche with those email addresses pretty regularly. And so, that's just one data point, but it like is, I mean, for people to be signing up with services to new services with that email. And I guess I would say like, I have one thing I've consistently used it for is like I know that their filtering is so good. And so if I'm signing up for things that I think are going to lead to like a ton of email, then I do use it for that because of the kind of filtering. And maybe that's why people are using it on Capiche. But I think that, I don't know. I mean, the biggest thing for me is that they require you to switch. The entire company has to adopt it. And I just feel like this product is, like, I think what's cool about what they did is that it's really bold. They literally are trying to like reinvent the concept of email as opposed to just building new kind of workflows. And I think that that's cool, but it's an incredibly opinionated product that like, even in our tiny company, it would feel kind of aggressive to just like force that upon everybody. And in much bigger companies, I mean, I don't know. That's the thing that for me, that's kind of like, I'm very curious to see, I don't know, like are big companies really going to adopt this? But I do think that the thing that's really cool is that it's obviously a company that you can trust and can expect to continue to like execute. And I think that there are all sorts of ways that email could be better handled within a company. Like I love the superhuman snippets, but I've always thought that snippets shared within an organization would be like a really powerful thing. And I think with Hey, all of those features that they have around like, you know, shared filtering and whatever else, I just feel like there's a lot of stuff that they could do that could make workflows much better within a company. And so I think there's some really cool stuff, but it's the fact that you have to switch wholesale as a company, I don't know. That's definitely like a pretty huge thing to ask of a company. So I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, great point. It feels like often, I don't know, Basecamp, I wouldn't exactly refer to as a startup, but a startup mentality, right, of products. They best serve brand new companies, right? If you were starting from scratch today and you didn't have an internal email system yet, and your team's been collaborating maybe with the Gmail account or whatever, and you were like, yeah, you know, we're ready to turn this into a real thing. Let's sign up for Hey. It would fit perfectly then because you're starting out from day one with this new service. But if you've already rolled out an existing email service, it's so disruptive to switch that from a perspective of almost everything. You've got your email archive that you're still going to have to keep around, which Hey is still not pulling in. You've got just logins and everything that end up coming into your email address that are so important. So asking companies to disrupt that is pretty interesting. I think it'd be hard to get people to switch. I could see definitely smaller startups, teams of 3 to 5 to 10 or something being willing to switch more. Convincing an enterprise-sized company to switch, yeah, that'll be tough. But I guess the challenge for them then are the benefits they can add to email as a service enough to warrant the switch. Whereas, say, with Superhuman or Front or almost any other app, you're just asking people to bring their existing G Suite or Office 365 email into this new app, and then everything still works. The service is still the same. You're just changing the interface. And the big thing Hey has changed here is that they're saying, hey, let's actually change the service you're using. And that's a big switch. So we'll see. But, you know, Google obviously made it work with Gmail over the years and became the default solution for new companies spinning up email in their company. So there may be space for Hey. It'll be interesting to see how it works out.
Yeah.
Sorry, Austin.
I was going to say, most companies also would not be able to cancel their G Suite subscription in doing this migration because otherwise they lose. I mean, like, you don't even have Google Calendar if you switch to this entirely.
Right.
That's like just a complete non-starter. And so, I don't know, I would say if I'm making predictions here, I would predict that they add a single player mode that like sits on top of Gmail, but I don't know, maybe because the way that they built this product really that would be a pretty fundamental change, but like, I really find it hard to believe that they're going to get a lot of adoption of this if it requires that you actually move all of the DNS over and versus just like having some way of like letting it be a wrapper on top of your Gmail or Outlook. But I don't know. Maybe they can
do
it.
Yeah, that's a great point because it speaks to the power of bundles of being so sticky, because you're still going to need a way to share files in your team and Office suite of sorts. And like you mentioned, Google Calendar, and this is just email. And so it's trying to split up the bundle without, I guess, great options for every other part of the bundle. So you still end up needing something like G Suite. And in fact, I'm not even sure how that would work if you had a G Suite account on your domain, like us at Capiche today, right? We have G Suite on capiche.com. And if we said, okay, fine, we're going to move our email to Hey, I'm not actually sure how that would work out from a DNS perspective. Like, what would you then use to log into your G Suite account, right? Because that's tied to capiche.com, right? That would get
so
weird.
You'd
almost need a separate domain.
You have to turn off the mail records, but you can keep G Suite associated with the domain, and then you can still log in. But yeah, I mean, it's like,
they're going to send login emails to Hey, I guess.
Yeah, and to even try it, you would have to make all these DNS changes. And so, like, it says they have a free – oh, no, it actually says they don't have a free trial. But you would – oh, yeah, so change your mind in 30 days, I guess. But, like, you just – it's like, I don't know. I mean, to get people to make that massive of a migration, especially when we've seen over a decade of this trend away from, like, massive commitment changes and toward, like, you know, single-player products that one person can just start using and that are growing bottom-up in organizations. And I think that, like, but I don't know, Basecamp, I think a lot of their audience is like agencies and that type of thing that are probably somewhat small. Maybe they understand their market. Certainly they understand their market more than I do. I'm very curious to see how it plays out, I guess is all I'll say.
Right. The business, like one business I could imagine switching of someone I know, my friend's business has about, I believe, 6 or 7 people. And they had used email that was just run by their internet provider for years, or rather not internet provider, but their hosting service. So it was on their domain, but it was just like basically you had a POP3 SMPTE email sync and you're using the built-in mail app on your phone. And that was how they'd done email for years. And they kept hitting storage limits because that kind of service is only allowing them to store, like, say, 500 megabytes per person. Anyhow, long story short, they'd switched to Basecamp recently to manage pretty much everything in their company. And I could see a team like that, right, that was generally not as much of a, I guess, tech-forward company and not already having a huge amount of SaaS products in a company that maybe already likes using Basecamp to manage agency projects and stuff like that. And they might need a better email solution. And so whether today they're using individual Gmail accounts or they're using some weird domain-based email, that may be the people that Basecamp could send to switch almost better than, say, someone who's already got G Suite set up, for instance. Possibly that's the market. That are
absolute
brand-new companies.
I guess maybe it's just like the people that are in the sort of Basecamp cult following, which is definitely a real thing. And,
right.
And I think those maybe would be the types of people that, and if the whole company is kind of like power users of Basecamp and really trust the company and all those things, then maybe it would be like a little bit easier kind of thing to rally behind. But it's, I mean, I just can't imagine in a 100-person company or a 1,000-person company to just one day like have to tell everyone this is your new email setup. It's just
right.
It's like such a massive change. And yeah,
absolutely.
I don't know.
Well, speaking of the difficulty of getting people to change, that sort of segues into our next topic. But this reminds me, if you're listening and you have any thoughts about pay for work, especially if you've tried it, please text in. We'd love to have you come on the call and talk about your experience so far or anything else that's new in SaaS this week that's come to your attention. Feel free to text it in. We'd love to chat about that on the call as well. So the next thing that I had on the list of interesting stuff over the past few weeks is e-commerce. So obviously this year has, to a big degree, quickly pulled forward some of the growth from, of course, delivery services, but then also e-commerce, where as people are at home more and during lockdowns especially, e-commerce has saved the day and kept people being able to buy stuff and get things they need. And one company that's interesting in this space this year is Fast, who is basically trying to build a better checkout flow and a better login flow for websites. So you sign up, you add your payment info, and then if you're logged in with Fast and you go to a Fast-powered checkout, you can essentially check out in a click, is what they're promising, is that you can just, you're already signed in, you've got your payment info in there, and it just goes. And the same thing can work for site logins as well, which they are both backed by Stripe and running with Stripe. So basically, it's still running your payments through Stripe. It's just a slightly simpler way to get your payment info into a site, right? Because Stripe is already a fairly fast checkout experience, and this just makes it a little bit faster, right? And I think the interesting thing
it's shipping. Shipping information also, and like sizes, I think, like, and some of those things. Mm. So, but the shipping information is the kind of key difference there. And so like, Amazon, I don't know if they have it globally, if you have the Amazon one click, but it's pretty convenient.
Yep.
And that, I mean, that for me is like actually kind of a huge, it's just like on Amazon, it's so nice because your payment is saved, your shipping is saved, and that you know the shipping is going to be 2 days, and you just like press one button and you're done. And then when you're like e-commerce site, it's like it can be 9 steps and you have no idea really what the shipping even is going to be. And
So Fast feels like that for every other website, basically.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the way
that
they would describe it. Yeah, it's like Amazon one-click checkout for the entire internet.
Interesting. So I feel like the interesting thing here is that what Fast offers versus, so you've also got Apple Pay, which is doing biometrics-based checkout, which is also remembering shipping addresses, though not sizes. But say you hit Apple Pay on a Shopify site, you're going to end up tapping twice on your phone or in some way authenticating yourself biometrically. And then it's going to fill in your payment info, your shipping address, And even sometimes showing the calculation of the shipping right there in one. Of course, you've got Amazon Pay, which lets you use your Amazon account to sign in and pay with stuff, which is what Kickstarter used to use, so that's gone away. And then you've got Shopify Pay, which is doing an account-based payment where if you're on any Shopify store that uses Shop Pay, you can use that. And then, of course, there's the traditional PayPal, right, which is, I guess, the old school first shot at this of trying to have one account for all your payments. So it feels like there's like this big competitive space of trying to both simplify the checkout process and then like you need to do just something a little bit better to convince people to sign up for this service and use it instead of other things as your default checkout method.
Yeah, I mean, I think as far as the, well, I think that the ways they can accomplish it are, I guess, having a really simple kind of way for a consumer to sign up on a merchant's website. And then, but then the most important thing is convincing the merchant not just to like add this button, but to funnel their customers into using this checkout. And I think there are probably ways to do it. And I think there might be kind of a company that's entirely focused on the checkout process could potentially kind of find ways to deliver that in a, like, and especially, I guess, as their user base grows. So once Fast has, can say, we have this many people who will be able to check out with one click on your website, but in order to do that, you have to give us this prominent placement with the people that are not our users or something. So I don't know, there might be ways that they can kind of do that. And I think, but it's clearly competitive, I guess, for me, from a consumer perspective. I mean, where Fast started was with one-click login, and I guess I've always felt like, I think Facebook login or Facebook OAuth is like such a powerful concept because everyone has Facebook, and so websites could just add it. But it's like annoying for your like identity across the web to be tied to a social network / ad company.
Absolutely.
And I've always felt like it would be cool if there was like an more kind of independent identity layer across the web. And I don't know, I'm not sure if that's exactly where Fast is going, but where they started, at least with the login. And if you think about like more kind of information of yours that could be held within this third party company. And then when you're on a website, you can choose whether that information gets passed on to the company. And I think it's interesting. It's there's so much happening, like even with the login, Apple has now this login, which is amazing. It's like you can obscure your email address from the services that that you're signing up for. And I've used that every time I've had the option to since they added it, because it's amazing to not have to give up your email address. But I think, I don't know. I mean, it is very, there probably won't be 15 different one-click pay buttons on these merchant websites in 5 years. And so, so it's probably going to be pretty, aggressive competition, I guess, would be my take.
Yeah, I bet. It's interesting with Apple. Feels like they are obviously very well positioned in this space, both from logins, as you mentioned, with sign-in with your Apple ID, and then from payments with Apple Pay. But then at the same time, there's to a small degree held back by essentially a strategy tax, as I think Ben Thompson would refer to it, where basically everything Apple does is tied to devices, right? So you aren't going to be able to use your Apple ID to log in if you're a PC and Android user. You're not going to have Apple Pay unless you're using Safari or an App Store powered app. And so that vastly restricts Apple's market and thus the potential for their offering here to become the default for everyone is almost impossible just because it's tied to Apple devices. And so there is this opportunity to provide almost an Apple level quality of login and payment info without being tied to an Apple device, which is a very interesting potential.
Yeah, and I think that's true kind of with each of these different solutions, like Amazon Pay. Most of them have their own sort of agenda. And if you're
– right.
I mean, if you're talking to merchants who are outside of Amazon's ecosystem, that's there's probably for a reason that they are not selling on Amazon. And so,
yeah.
And so I think the idea of like continuing to give your data to Amazon is maybe not like the kind of strongest sell, although a lot of people use it. And then Shopify obviously like is most likely going to always stay within their ecosystem, which is massive, but still not everything. And then I think PayPal really is the only one that feels like it's entirely within the space of like the just payments, but then they have like a wide range of other products beyond the kind of checkout stuff. And yeah, I don't know.
Right. And almost a legacy history of having not always had the exact best experience. And of course being tied to eBay historically. Of course PayPal split out and independent now, but that was the default eBay payments for years. Speaking of e-commerce otherwise, there's two other big things. So Shopify and TikTok announced a partnership for social commerce. So if you've seen people live streaming as they're selling products, I know this is super popular in Asia, where you have, maybe you have handcraft items or you have local grown produce that you're selling online, and people live stream and show the products that they're selling while they're actively recruiting people to buy them. And so you have your follower base and they're watching you say, go through your inventory. And then they can be like, hey, I want this one, and go ahead and place an order while you're on the video. And interesting, basically Shopify and TikTok seem to be trying to grab some of that, of course, not from a live perspective for them, but from a recorded video perspective, where you make something viral that's going to go popular on TikTok, and then ideally use that to sell stuff from your Shopify shop. And then at the same time, Facebook, which of course is where most social commerce is happening today, both from you list products on Facebook pages, and then you maybe buy it through messenger conversations. Facebook's trying to now formalize that with another shot at adding e-commerce to Facebook. They've done this a few times. This one feels the most full-featured so far. So they're adding what they're calling Facebook shops to list products directly in your Facebook page, WhatsApp chat, and Instagram profile. So it's across all of Facebook's properties. You list products essentially like you would in a Shopify store, and you can have a built-in checkout experience right from Facebook. And so both of these are, I guess, trying to tap into how we discover products we want to buy, where Amazon's all search-focused, right? Facebook and social is the more demand-driven e-commerce as a way to go out there and promote your products and then get people to buy them. So, Austin, have you ever bought anything from a Facebook store before? Is that common there too?
I haven't, and I'm trying to remember even, I deactivated my Facebook like 2 or maybe 3 years ago, and I don't know, I guess Facebook Marketplace was around, but I don't know, I don't think there was, I guess I'm not sure if I even really had too much opportunity to do that, and I mean, I definitely have bought things from Instagram ads, and I think that actually could be like a smoother experience, although it's also dangerous because you just see the ads all the time. I guess like the thing that I think about here is like QVC, where they just which I guess maybe that's still on TV, and Home Shopping
the
Network.
Shopping channels,
and,
right?
I mean, yeah, and people would watch that for hours and hours, and it's just like, you know, someone talking about this product, and they like keep offering different deals and whatever. And it's like, it is kind of like mesmerizing, I guess. And it clearly works because those channels definitely like move a ton of product. And so, I don't know. I think it is definitely interesting. I had a friend who a few years ago was thinking about trying to build a sort of like, I guess the idea was sort of QVC for everybody. So like, a kind of live streaming and where anyone can open up the app and just see who's selling whatever. And I think, I mean, these things seem like they're kind of in that direction. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, the thing with Facebook is like, they have so much scale that these products, they can launch a product and you can like forget about it and never even see it yourself and not, and like never hear your friends talking about it. And then like suddenly realize that it's doing like some insane amount of volume. Yeah, I don't know. It seems like they've had success with all their commerce stuff, even though as a consumer, I don't feel like I've even like seen a whole lot of it.
Interesting. Yeah. It's funny how commerce to a certain degree can be entertainment. So the top, I believe it was the top or near the top of revenue on YouTube from the past year was kids doing these unboxing videos, right? Where they have a kid sitting there unboxing a toy and other kids just watch this stuff and then presumably end up pressing their parents to buy the toy. And it just drives a massive amount of traffic and presumably a massive amount of sales for those toys that are being unboxed. And here in Thailand, a few weeks ago, there was a story in the news about a lady who was buying, what was it, clothes from people who had passed away and telling essentially ghost stories while selling used clothes on this Facebook channel. And it was around Halloween, and it just got this huge following just of people tuning in to listen to these like ghost stories tied to buying secondhand clothing. And ended up being covered in the news just because of the oddness of the thing. But basically, it's commerce as entertainment. And it's funny. It's like obviously product placement in, say, James Bond movies or whatever is that. But here it's just a direct thing where you're literally sitting there watching stuff being sold as entertainment. So definitely a thing.
Yeah, interesting.
Speaking of social, did you try out the new Twitter Fleeps today?
Yes, I did. I guess I can describe it. So, I mean, it's Instagram stories.
I haven't had a chance to try it out yet.
Yeah. It feels like a kind of minimal clone of, I don't know if I've tried all of them, but I used Snapchat stories back in the day, and then obviously Instagram seems to be the most popular implementation of this concept. LinkedIn just added it, and now Twitter. And I know Twitter has been testing it in a few countries for quite a while, I think. And then just today rolled it out to all users everywhere. And I don't know. It's like I feel. Let's see. It's in some ways frustrating that Twitter is so slow to innovate. Like they still haven't added DM search, and after all these years, and that would just be like such a valuable thing because at this point we all have like years upon years of messages in there, and it would be really cool to be able to find them. And so like there's that kind of pace of innovation can sometimes be frustrating, but at the same time I think part of what has made Twitter so good and like really, I mean, for me at least, it's been the one social network that seems to appreciate in value to me over time compared to all the others, which like I slowly sort of just burn out on. And I think that's probably the kind of staying to their core probably has a lot to do with that, I think. And so it makes me nervous that like, when there are all these features that so many people just want, like DM search, that just there's no negative case for them adding that type of feature, whereas this is like a huge fundamental change to the product and makes me nervous. But I think that I don't know. I mean, that's also, I guess, because I just am a huge fan of Twitter and I get so much out of it, and opening up the app and seeing this, it's like, I don't know. They've been doing the live video where if anyone you follow is live, that like shows up in the top bar. And I guess this is kind of similar. I guess I'll say I would be very surprised for me personally, if I'm actively checking all of these stories, and I just follow so many more people than I do on other platforms. So I'm like scrolling through, maybe because it's the first day, but I have like endless, there must be 200 different people who are on here, and like I'm not going to catch up with that today, let alone every day. I don't know, maybe that's the kind of first day everyone wanted to try it, but I don't know. I guess the last thing I'll say about it is so much of the use, so much of just content on Instagram in general is from Twitter. It's screenshots of tweets because they're like all the funny, like the memes and stuff, all or tons of them generate on Twitter, and then the screenshots end up like being posted on those places. And so I guess maybe like this makes it a little bit easier to close that loop. It's just, I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm curious what you think.
Yeah. So it's funny. I still have a Facebook account, but I haven't really posted anything there in years, literally maybe 3 or 4 years. And I've kept it active basically for Messenger because enough people that I chat with use that as the default. And as I mentioned before, for commerce, comically enough, where some stuff that's how you order it. Anywho, Instagram is my preferred social network, more or less. And stories, I didn't like it first, but weirdly, they've made the product feel more sticky for me because I'm not going to publish something very personal in Instagram publicly, but I might throw it in a story, and it feels like a lot of friends are doing a similar thing there. So I would wonder with Twitter if this ends up, you know, people tweet something and they're like, you know, I'll tweet this, might delete it later or something. I guess that may be a use case, right, for the stories to a certain degree, but it does feel like a fundamental shift in how Twitter's worked. So here's a weird one. I followed a few Twitter accounts over the past few months that do live video often. And those always pop up at the top of my feed. And it's usually news channels. And so it's basically they end up being top of mind. Those accounts end up being top of mind for me far more than normal people in my feed just because they show up at the very top. And I guess that may be the thing with stories is if Twitter does some filtering there or they end up figuring out who are the stories you probably want to watch the most and then always put those at the top, it might end up being a way to keep up with specific accounts or specific groups of friends better than just your full feed. But I'm not sure if that will, of course, require Twitter to do a lot of sort of filtering and machine learning optimization. And I just don't exactly feel like that's the kind of thing that Twitter usually focuses that much on. So we'll see.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you that I think Instagram stories like is more interesting to me than the actual feed. And I think no matter what, these things end up competing with each other. And so to me, maybe that's why I'm nervous is like, if this is successful, then it just becomes that. And like it kind of detracts from the thing that makes Twitter special, which is that it's like always just been this global real-time conversation. And so like, I don't know, I'd rather see them doubling down on that and making that better versus like making this product more like Instagram, even if Instagram is great. So I don't know. I'm not saying I don't think it'll be successful. I have no idea, but I definitely don't know if I want it to be successful.
That makes sense. I didn't exactly want stories to be successful on Instagram at first. It felt like just a pure ripoff of Snapchat, which had never clicked for me. I never use Snapchat regularly. And so then they added this to Instagram and I'm like, hey man, I like Instagram. Like, don't mess with it. And then it grew on me. So we'll see. Speaking of photos, there was a change this month announced. It doesn't change yet. But if you've used Google Photos, which is Google's default photo app on Android devices, but then you can run it on any platform. And its best feature has been that you get unlimited storage for photos historically. So if you had signed up for Google Photos, it could basically just run through your entire photo library on your phone, upload what they call a low quality copy of your photo. It was basically, I believe, 10 megapixels. So lower quality than say a DSLR, but for the most part, the same as what your phone shooting. And it would store those in the cloud and it said they would just store unlimited photos forever. Well, that's changed. Google has announced that as of June 1st, 2021, every new photo or video uploaded will count against your Google storage. So if you add photos today or until June, you could still theoretically back up your entire photo library to Google Photos for free. That doesn't count against your storage as of now. But any new photos added in the future will start counting against your Google storage. And there's a rumor The Verge talked about Google Photos app. They start putting some of their editing features behind a paywall. So it's another one of those things where Google's offered just a massive amount of stuff for free for years. And it feels like a lot of that's being pulled back now as they're trying to, I guess, find a revenue model for things beyond just Google search. So, if you're using Google Photos, that's worth remembering that your
unlimited free storage may end up going away as of next year.
Yeah, I guess I think that like with a lot of, we've talked about these storage products a bunch, and I mean the kind of,
yeah,
I guess the, with a lot of these products, whatever the, it's Moore's law is moves fast enough that that they can like continue to kind of offer more and more storage. But in the case of unlimited photos, the camera sensors and like the types of images, like going from still images to the like live photo type things, and the amount of video and all of it, it's just like getting the photos that you, I don't know when Google Photos initially started doing this unlimited photos thing, but the average iPhone photo file size, whenever it was,
right,
it was 5 years ago or 10 years ago or something compared to today. I would be actually be really curious to see that like mapped out, how much, what the average file size of a photo taken on an iPhone 12 Pro is compared to a, I don't know, iPhone 4, iPhone 5 or something like that.
There was something the other day where they were comparing the raw photo size. I'm trying to see if I can pull this up. Where the new iPhone 12 now natively supports shooting raw photos, similar to a DSLR. And each of those photos, just found this, it says they're going to be 25 megabytes. So you're shooting one photo and it's going to take up 25 megabytes. So you get 1 gig, then it's going to give you about 4,000 photos, which, yeah, that's going to start taking up space really fast. And if you're shooting 4K footage, that goes even further, right? Like that's going to use up a vastly mm-hmm. larger amount of storage. So yeah, that is definitely a challenge. And I felt like the thing with Google originally was, I guess we just all assumed they were using these photos to train their machine learning algorithms. And so they wanted the free photos for that. And that maybe the benefit of that's gone now. And they're like, hey, wait, this is actually a cost center. And let's start using this to push people towards a Google One subscription. So,
yeah.
Yeah. One final story for the week is podcast. So there's been a few big things in podcasts over the past few weeks. One just yesterday is the Apple Podcast, which is essentially the original online podcast library. It's historically been tied to iTunes. You go into iTunes and search for podcasts and listen to them there. Apple's now bringing that to the web to a small degree. So you can now embed a Apple Podcast podcast player in your site, either as a player for an individual episode or with your entire podcast, where you essentially have an embed that has a playlist of your previous episodes. So that's on Apple's side, which there's also a rumor from Bloomberg that Apple and Sony are both considering acquiring a podcast network, Wonderly, after Spotify pulled out. So Spotify has been building this library of premium podcasts that are owned by Spotify. And the rumors here would be that Apple's considering doing a similar move where they would be bringing more podcasts in-house. Spotify, on their side, has been apparently considering launching a paid podcast subscription tier based on a survey they've been sending out, asking people if they'd be willing to pay $3 to $8 a month for access to Spotify-only shows. And then at the same time of more concrete news, Spotify acquired Megaphone, which was a podcast hosting and ad company. For $235 million, which Megaphone uses Nielsen data to segment audiences and use that to target ads dynamically, which they host the Wall Street Journal's podcast, Vox, BuzzFeed, among others. And this gives Spotify a massive amount of data on podcasts, and with their massive user base, potentially a way to target ads better at listeners and then also offer premium subscriptions if you want to have perhaps an ad-free podcast listening experience. So it's interesting to see how podcasts have turned into this massive new media area where all the major tech players seem to be trying to get a slice of the pie.
Yeah, let's see. There's a lot to unpack there. I mean, I think it's really, it is definitely really interesting. And I mean, the thing is, so there's no question that like podcasting is going to move to dynamic ad delivery. Like as much as the host read ads are really valuable, and maybe there will be hosts that continue to read ads for a long time, but overall, it's just so clear that the kind of efficiency of dynamic delivery is, because of the targeting and all those things, is just like so significant that these things are all going to move in that direction. And everyone who's done it right now is, I mean, Megaphone, I don't fully know how this works, but I guess they're hosting the podcast, and then they are delivering, I really don't even actually understand how they're able to give different users different ads, unless there's a different RSS feed or something like that. So that part I'm like really just not super sure about.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm actually not sure how they're doing that.
Yeah.
I guess based on the app they're listening in, that wouldn't make much sense though.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm really not sure. But I think Spotify, if anyone is going to build like a sort of dynamic ad network specifically for podcasts, Spotify is obviously like the contender because they already have a ton of volume. They do a ton of ad revenue and have advertisers, and then they
right.
can just like the kind of scale is the hardest piece of this. And so I think that, I don't know, it's interesting. I'm like not a huge fan of Spotify doing this closed ecosystem, not embracing RSS for podcasts. So they really are trying to build
right.
a kind of closed wall world for podcasts. But, have been impressed that Apple has not ever tried to do that.
Yeah,
seems to be
so.
More, I mean, like the news that you just read through really kind of actually highlights these differences, like Apple rolling out web embeds, so like basically making the ecosystem more open, and then Spotify buying a company that's going to probably let them do dynamic injection of ads so that podcast hosts potentially would like be making more money if they move if they adopt certain Spotify things or whatever. I mean, anything that is
yeah.
going to like help them lure podcasts into their walled garden. And I'm not sure. It's very clear that Spotify is ready to bet big on this though.
Definitely. Yeah. To your point on how Megaphone is targeting ads, I just tried to look through their site and I didn't figure it out in a quick overview, but it does make sense from a Spotify perspective, right? Where Spotify would have this data on you from a demographic perspective, from your listening habits on music, which I presume you could extrapolate a reasonable amount of stuff from that. And then they could easily then serve dynamic ads in the podcast stream from that. Something that wouldn't be possible with, or I'm not sure how it is possible with other podcast apps. So the monetization potential there for Spotify and by extension, other podcasts hosted on their network are much larger. Where Apple has kept it very much almost like traditional RSS, right? Where it's just like this open system where you can submit your feed and it just runs through Apple's system almost as a directory service, but everything else is hands off, which is almost unlike Apple, right? It's not standard of them to run more or less an open service that's more or less just powered by the open web. So that's very interesting. And also, of course, Apple focuses on a privacy perspective with a lot of their software now. So I would tend to think that things like dynamic ads and such targeting in podcasts would be much more difficult, if not impossible, in Apple's ecosystem. Though with Apple trying to sell bundles now, if they did acquire a podcast network, that would be interesting to see. Like, do they plan to add premium podcasts, say, to Apple News, or what would be the play there? So I guess that's what'll be interesting to watch, how that shakes out.
Yeah, totally.
Awesome. Well, I think that's a wrap for today. Thank you, everyone, so much for tuning in and listening to this week's tech news. And tomorrow morning, we have a special guest on SaaS Radio Hour. Last week, I had talked with the founder of Ulysses, the Mac and iOS writing app. And tomorrow morning at, hold on one second, at 6 a.m. Pacific and 9 a.m. Eastern,
we will have IA Writers founder on the call, and he'll be talking about their team's writing app and the decisions they've made. So Ulysses is a subscription-powered app. IA Writer is a one-time purchase. And so I think there's an interesting dynamic between the decisions those companies made with how to market their product and how to sell it. And we'll be looking forward to asking him questions on the call tomorrow morning. If you have any questions you'd like us to ask, whether you'll be able to listen in live or not, just go ahead and text them to this phone number, and we'll be sure to include them in the podcast tomorrow. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll catch you next time. Bye.
Thanks, Matt. See ya.